All right, good morning. My name is David Nahai, and I serve as chair of the Los Angeles Regional Water Board. Today is Thursday, May 28th. It is exactly 9:13 a.m., and I'm calling this meeting to order. For people who only want to listen or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is available. There is a direct link to the webcast on the meeting agenda posted on our website. In addition, we're receiving presentations and public comments through a Zoom meeting platform and in person. For this board meeting, Spanish interpretation services will not be available. Please note that for all Regional Water Board meetings, there is no expectation of privacy regarding any communications. Meetings are recorded and names of participants are listed in the Zoom forum. Participation in a recorded meeting will be deemed consent to be recorded. Before we begin, I'd like to sincerely thank the City of Simi Valley for holding our meeting at Council Chambers this morning, despite the emergency the city encountered last week with the Sandy Fire that burned over 2,000 acres and thousands of residents were forced to evacuate. The city staff have been supportive, flexible, responsive, and we're truly appreciative for accommodating us today. Next, we're going to move on to our roll call and the declaration of a quorum. So could we have the roll call, please, Ms. Bolivar? Where is she?
Vice Chair Ashian.
Present.
Board Member Camacho. Board Member Christensen.
Present.
Board Member Mendez.
Present.
Chair Nahai.
Yes.
Roll call completed. Thank you.
Thank you. And a quorum is physically present. I'd like to move on now to the next item, which is the order of the agenda. Please note that agenda items are numbered for identification purposes only and may not necessarily be considered in this order. So let me ask our executive officer, Susana Arredondo, if there are any changes to the order of the agenda.
Chair, there are no changes to the agenda. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're going to move on now to item number 3 on the agenda, which is the approval of draft minutes for the April 23rd, 2026 meeting. So I would ask for a motion to approve and a second unless there are any changes from any of the board members. Could I have a motion, please?
So moved.
Thank you. A motion from Board Member Ashtian.
Second.
And a second from Board Member Christensen. Thank you. Could we call the roll?
Vice Chair Ashian?
Yes.
Board Member Christensen?
Yes.
Board Member Mendez?
Yes.
Chair Nahai?
Yes.
The motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you. Motion carries. We'll move on now to item number 4 on the agenda, which are board member communications. I will first ask if any of the board members have any ex parte disclosures to report. So, Board Member Christian?
No.
Thank you. Board Member Mendez?
No.
Vice Chair Ashton?
None, thank you.
And there are no items for me to report on board member communications. Next, we'll move on to board member reports, and these are items that board members may wish to discuss on general matters. So I'll ask first Board Member Christensen.
Yes, thank you so much. And apologies to everybody for my tardiness. It was quite the drive. So I think top of mind for me and possibly for all of you are the news reports that have been out about the Garden Grove tank and the evacuation that had to happen because they were fearing it was going to explode and send toxins into the area. Happy to know that the pressure there has been relieved a little bit, but the pressure has been relieved because the tank cracked. And this really obviously made me think about us and similar facilities that we have in our region. And so I'm just really interested in hearing from staff, maybe in the executive officer's report, about the safeguards and the protocols that we have in place for a similar situation. Similarly, also thinking about the Sandy fire, as Chair Nahai brought up, and I think probably everybody here who was tracking it remembers that moment that LA Times reported that the fire was tracking in the direction of the Santa Susana Field Lab, which, of course, on top of the pollutants that are already there, a reburning of those certainly wouldn't be good. So I, again, would be interested in understanding whether or not Boeing has any plans for kind of what seems like an inevitable fire. Like, what sort of resources do they plan to put towards that? And on a lighter and more hopeful note, I had the opportunity of attending a symposium at UCLA on rebuilding resilience after the LA fires that happened in 2025. And I was happy to see a room full of not just fire agencies or forest ecologists, but public health officials, community members, and really looking at fire resilience, not just as how do we buffer our homes and our and how do we treat our forests, but how do we look at our region as climate impacted at all times in many different ways and start to build resilience across those impacts. I think in our field, we're still dealing with a lot of siloed approaches, but this one symposium really made me feel like maybe those silos are actually starting to break down a little bit, and that we may be approaching a more comprehensive era of planning for resilience and adaptation. And that is it for me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, I'd like to reiterate my fellow board members' comments about the difficult times that our regions of Los Angeles County and Orange County have experienced, from wildfires to toxic chemical leaks from petrochemical companies, and quite concerning for where we're at right now about the wildfires, and as my fellow board member has mentioned, about the drastic danger of having a toxic facility, a former nuclear facility that could possibly endanger the wider community if a tragic event happens. So I look forward to finding, getting a little bit more answers and clarity about what Boeing and others that are responsible for that site are doing to safeguard the public health. But more importantly, I also want to speak about another issue in our area that got less attention, is East Los Angeles and the oil spill that happened when a utility or contracting company burst a oil pipeline and sent tens of gallons of oil to throughout the streets, and impacting the health and safety of local public schools, as well as community residents and businesses that live by. And then, of course, that oil going into our water systems and down into the LA River, severely impacting our marine and aquatic life. I know our executive director will be speaking a little bit more about that, but that's on top of mind. I know a lot of our environmental NGOs, environmental justice groups in Los Angeles are quite concerned. And while we do have these very spectacular events that happen here in Simi Valley, as well in our sister watershed in Orange County, it's important to look at what's happening in East Los Angeles and in environmental justice community, and our impacts to our marine and aquatic life, and of course our waterways. Thank you.
I just wanted to share that a couple of us went to the WQCC earlier this month, us virtually and some in person. I wanted to thank State Board staff and everyone involved for sharing a lot of the emerging topics, including data centers, AI, and PFAS, and a lot of the issues that we're starting to grapple with and discuss as a state and discuss amongst other board members. So I thought that was very helpful. Wanted to thank our executive officer for giving a presentation about the work that has been done in our region. That was a highlight of this month to be able to participate in, and wish I was able to participate in person. I also just wanted to share that our Santa Monica Bay Restoration Commission, our next meeting is June 18th, if anyone wants to attend that. And also echo the comments and the concerns from my fellow board members with regard to a lot of the incidents that we're seeing. And I think it highlights the importance of this work, the importance of all of you in this space when these events start to garner attention. And so I look forward to our discussions about how we can continue to safeguard the public and what we can do proactively so that we are not in situations where we're stuck. And I also think that the work that was done with regard to the fire, both the Sandy fire and also just previous fire in Los Angeles last year, highlights that collaboration and multi-agency work that's being done. And so when disaster happens, we're ready, we're prepared, we know what to do, we know who to interact with. And so I just want to commend our staff for really working on that proactively, because it's not if when these disasters happen, it's when, and we really need to be ready, ready to go. So I want to thank staff, want to thank everyone who's here, and looking forward to the meeting. Thank you.
Thanks very much. So I've got a couple of things to report on. Well, first of all, regarding the Sandy fire, I think we were all holding our breath, hoping and perhaps praying that the fire would not reach the Santa Susana field, that with the possible, just unimaginable consequences that may have happened then. So just such a relief that our firefighters were able to contain the fire and prevent what could have been truly a catastrophe. Second thing to report, Vice Chair Ashton mentioned WQCC is another acronym. It stands for the Water Quality Coordinating Committee, and this is an annual gathering that is all of the members of all of the regional boards, all nine of them, gather in Sacramento for 2 days of very intensive discussions about water issues throughout the state. And Region 4, our region, was very well represented. Our executive officer did a very well-received presentation on the work that we've been doing here. And there are also chairs meetings that happen all the time as well. But this particular gathering is always very illuminating, because we also talk about all of the priorities going forward, things like AI, data centers, algal blooms, what is happening to our marine life and also water supply issues, water rights issues that come up. So I think with respect to this administration, this last WQCC will be the last one. The next one will have a new governor and possibly a new state board. I think the regional board members, those who have been confirmed by the state senate, will continue in their roles. But come November, I think we'll have a different administration in place. Next thing to report, next week, for 3 days, there will be a conference in Los Angeles called Verde Exchange. It's a conference that pretty much everybody who's in the environmental and business world goes to. I'll be a panelist on a plenary panel that will talk about first, our our actions in the aftermath of the Palisades and Eaton fires, but also talk about resiliency going forward. In other words, where is our water going to come from? You know, only people who pay absolutely no attention to the news would miss the fact that we've got a dire issue in the Colorado River. There's a report just recently that it's possible that Lake Mead will fall to a level that the Hoover Dam won't be able to generate electricity. I mean, this is the kind of dire situation that we're dealing with. And so the question becomes, where is our water going to come from in the future? And this is why this board has had such a focus on wastewater recycling. This is why our MS4 permit, requires that we all do so much more in order to save our rainfall rather than just have it run off to the ocean. These are the tools. This is why this board has been so involved with aquifer remediation, especially in the San Fernando Valley, because we have to clean up our groundwater. These are the tools, as well as conservation, of course, are the tools that are going to secure our water future here in Southern California. So that conference will be about that. And finally, I'm looking forward to attending my first regional oversight committee meeting, ROC meeting, for the Safe Clean Water program. This is the Measure W program, which provides water to the cities and the county in order to help them do more in terms of stormwater capture projects. So that's my report for the day. Okay, thanks very much. With that, we'll move on to our next item, which is our executive officer's report. Susanna Arredondo.
Thank you, Chair. I do have a few updates for the board, and like it was mentioned, the oil spill, which occurred at 400 Eastern Avenue in East Los Angeles, and I would like to provide some background and the current status. On the morning of May 22, 2026, an underground pipeline was struck near East Cesar Chavez and Northeastern Avenue in East Los Angeles, causing a release of approximately 2,400 gallons of light crude oil. Excuse me. The oil entered the local storm drains and discharged into the Los Angeles River. The pipeline was immediately shut down, and an investigation into the cause and total volume is ongoing. Management of the response is fully integrated under the Unified Command, consisting of the US EPA, CDFW Office of Spill Prevention Response, and LA County Fire Department, and the pipeline operator Pacific Pipeline System, LLC. As of the latest update, oil remains contained within the storm drains and the LA River. No product has been observed south of the Pacific Coast Highway Bridge. Out of an abundance of caution, a defensive contained boom has been deployed at Ocean Boulevard to protect Long Beach Harbor. Recovery operations are moving rapidly, utilizing vacuum trucks and skimmers to remove oil from the river. Pipeline repairs, contaminated soil removal, and a phased flushing of the underground storm drain systems are underway in coordination with LA County Public Works. Initial and ongoing air monitoring by LA County Fire, Health Hazmat, and South Coast AQMD confirms that there is no threat to public health. However, community members may notice elevated odors as excavation and storm drain cleaning continue. CDFW and the fire department and the contractor have collected water quality samples. The Oiled Wildlife Care Network is actively surveying and recovering affected wildlife, which are being treated at the LA Oiled Bird Care and Education Center. Over the weekend, staff provided support to the Unified Command regarding permitted discharges in the watershed, upstream flows, and worker safety. On Tuesday, staff checked in at the incident command post and visited the storm drain outfall where the discharge to the LA River occurred. On Wednesday, staff visited the incident area where the oil spilled originated, the storm drain outfall, and the cleanup areas downstream of the outfall. Staff observed active and diligent cleanup and the deployment of multiple layers of containment booms down to Ocean Boulevard. My next update, I have a brief update regarding Phillips 66 Carson and Wilmington refineries, which both ceased operations in late 2025 to prepare for future redevelopment. These interconnected facilities have operated for over a century, dating back to around 1920. Because of the long petroleum operations, environmental investigations have been ongoing since the 1980s under a consolidated cleanup and abatement order issued by this board. The order addressed underground contamination, specifically liquid petroleum plumes like crude oil and gasoline. Cleanup activities for both sites are focused on controlling impacts, preventing the mitigation of contamination beyond the site's boundaries, and cleanup contamination at the source areas. To give you an idea of the scale of the current cleanup and infrastructure, the Carson Refinery has 64 groundwater recovery wells alongside monthly product removal events that have been activated since 1986. At the Wilmington facility, 27-well dual-phase liquid extraction system is there, and specialized and also a specialized biosparge system along the northeastern border has been running since 1997. Looking forward to the impending decommissioning of the Wilmington and Carson refineries, Phillips 66 recently submitted a master work plan addendum. This framework will significantly accelerate and expedite our assessment and remediation during this transition from active refining to redevelopment. To keep the community fully informed, we directed Phillips 66 to prepare and mail a project update and notice of opportunity to comment on the master work plan addendum. That outreach has been completed. In addition, we'll be hosting an in-person open house and workshop on June 3rd in Wilmington and June 4th in Carson to help residents learn more about the cleanup approach and to provide input. Concurrently, we have entered into an agreement with the developer, Catalyst DECA LLC, for Wilmington under the California Land Reuse and Revitalization Act, or CLARA. CLARA facilitates brownfield redevelopments by providing a streamlined cleanup framework and a certain legal immunities to qualifying persons that voluntarily conduct site assessments and response actions at blighted properties. Work completed under the CLARA is still conducted under the Water Board's oversight, and the final response actions undergo environmental review under CEQA, as well as a separate public participation process through the CLARA. We also are in negotiations with the CLARA for the Carson refinery. The site ensures that this ensures that the new redevelopment related cleanup at both refinery sites will run in parallel with our ongoing regulatory oversight of Phillips 66 cleanup and abatement order. Since the developer and Catalyst DECA will address shallow soils at the two refinery sites through the CLARA, the work completed under the CAO focuses on addressing deeper soil, groundwater, and off-site impacts. So we will continue to update the board as we continue to reach future milestones. And that will conclude my report. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for our executive officer? Hearing none. All right, we'll go on to our next item, item number 6, which is an update from our State Board Liaison Board Member, Laurel Firestone.
Hi, good to see you all. All right, I'm going to give a few updates of the many things we've been up to. I don't need to go over the WQCC meeting, but I really appreciate all of the involvement, and it's an amazing event, so I encourage folks that weren't able to attend this year to attend next year. A couple things going on to highlight for this board are the Clean Water State Revolving Fund intended use plan. This is the annual plan for how we intend to use our clean water state revolving funds, which comes from the state, and it's a revolving fund with both mostly loan, but also some principal forgiveness. We held a workshop on our initial proposal. Comments were due yesterday, and we anticipate having a board meeting to consider adoption of a final proposal in July. We also held a really amazing annual update on our racial equity action plan. And just encourage folks, if you're interested, first of all, there's a really great interactive report available online, and it allows you to see updates by divisions and offices, stages of completion. And just to note, this is the final year of this action plan. And so this summer, we are kicking off a public process to develop the action plan for the next 3 years. So just, it was really uplifting and nice to focus on the progress that we've made and also what we're learning and looking to moving forward, especially in these times when there's been a attack on these sorts of values, and just affirming that as well. As it was a really great, you can also watch it online if you're interested, but encourage people to check that out. There's an annual report that's really excellent as well, available online. We have been doing a lot in water rights. We issued a draft decision on the draft permit for the Sites Reservoir project. And comments were already due on that earlier this month. We received a lot of comments, and we'll be considering that and are aiming for consideration of a final as early as September 1st. We are doing a lot of hearings on the Delta Conveyance Project in June, most of the month. our administrative hearings office is conducting hearings. So folks that are interested in that, there's a lot going on there this month. Our agricultural expert panel is finalizing its recommendations in response to panel charge questions. This is particularly, again, around looking at questions around nitrate in groundwater in particular, and ways we might want to adapt our precedential order on that. And we anticipate that a final will be issued, and hopefully an information item will be before the state board on that in the second meeting of June, June 16th. Coming up in June, we have a lot of really interesting info items. So just to give you a sense, next week at our board meeting, staff will present a progress update on the supplier report submission and compliance with objectives for the Making Conservation a Way of Life regulation that was adopted in 2024. So this is you know, one of the first times we'll really be able to look at where folks are. And there's an exciting technical assistance program partnership going on. So, you know, folks that are interested in that, tune in on June 2nd. On June 16th, we're having an informational item on our Constituents of Emerging Concern program, and as well as 6 PPD quinone with additional sister agencies like DTSC and Department of Transportation. So that's, I think, you know, of interest to a lot of people, and encourage folks to tune in if you're interested in that. We are moving forward and having a workshop on proposed lead and copper rule improvements regulations. This is for drinking water. That's going to be June 11th, and there's a notice out for that. Let's see, a couple other things for this region that I thought you might be interested in is we have our Department of Transportation's annual update for the TMDL compliance plan for the statewide, Department of Transportation's municipal stormwater permit and written comments. That was the annual report was issued back in November, and written comments are need to be received by June 8th, but encourage folks that are involved in that or interested in that to take a look at that annual report. The last two things. One is we have Mono Lake public workshops. So this is staff holding public workshops to collect information on the condition of Mono Basin's public trust resources, evaluating potential management options. It's really looking at new data collected since the 1994 decision that we issued on Mono Lake. And we're having two workshops coming up. One is on June 4th. It's on water quality, salinity, brine shrimp, and alkali flies. And then the one on June 25th is on California gulls and other migratory birds. So folks that are interested in that should tune in for that. And I think lastly, I wanted to mention that we continue to hold stakeholder meetings about fees for this next fiscal year. So this includes the drinking water and laboratories, water quality, water rights. There's a number of workshops coming up, public meetings on June 11th, June 12th, and July 30th and 31st. So folks that want to weigh in on, you know, this is really how we have to fund all of our programs by statute. So a process we do every year to be really transparent about how those are set to cover the cost of our programs. All right, with that, I think that's everything I wanted to cover, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Truly wonderful presentation, as always. Thanks so much. So questions for Board Member Firestone?
Thank you, Board Member, for the wonderful update. Just if you can please forward us the information about the public process for the new racial equity plan that you will kick off this summer. And that will it be a webinar or in-person workshop?
You know, there's going to be a pretty extensive process through the Office of Public Engagement, Equity, and Tribal Affairs. And I don't believe it's been fully announced and noticed yet, but I will make sure that this board and the board members get information on that. It's my understanding is they're planning a series of meetings around the state as well as public workshops. So, and that is for creating actions for the next 3 years. So I think it's really important to get good participation and hope that I'll make sure that you all get it.
Oh, great. Thank you. We're excited about that kickoff. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Any other questions? Remember? Okay, no. Thank you very, very much. Really greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to now move on to item number 7, which is our public forum. So any person may address the board regarding any matter within the board's jurisdiction, provided that the matter does not appear elsewhere on this agenda, has not been scheduled to appear on a future agenda, and is not expected to be imminently scheduled for the board's consideration. So each speaker will have 3 minutes to address the board unless additional time has been approved in advance. So we ask that, as I said, 3 minutes on this additional time has been approved in advance. So the order of speakers will be those who are here in person, then those who wish to join remotely and who have registered in advance. But third would be other registered remote speakers. So after speakers who have registered in advance are called, then I will ask that others wishing to speak raise their Zoom hand and will be heard at that time. So speakers in person, we're going to hear first from Mr. Ray Tahir for 5 minutes on the subject of ex-party communications. Go ahead, please. No, we'll do your 5 minutes first on ex-party, then you can come back a second time for the 3 minutes. Okay.
Councilor Nunez informed me that notices were sent to permittees informing them of the need to prepare ROWDs and submit them by March 16, 2026. The notices are carbon copies of the ones that were sent in April of 2021. Council also said that permittees submitted the ROWDs by the March 16th deadline. According to the notice, the ROWDs can be seen by clicking on the FDP site using the correct username and password. But dialing into the FDP results in the following. There's no mention of the ROWDs. Note there are no ROWDs listed, which is also the case regarding the April 17, 2021 notice. So where are they? Also note that the Water Code Section 13167 requires identifying ROWDs as waste discharge requirements under announcements on the board's website, along with the posting of the ROWDs. The purpose is not only to verify that permittees submit the ROWDs, but also give the public the opportunity to review and comment on them. Next slide, please. Nevertheless, Council said that the Region Board has been treating the MS4 permit as a pending matter subject to the prohibition on ex parte communications as of March 16, 2026. This is consistent, according to her, to Law and Water Board guidance. Council and the Board are wrong on each justification. The current MS4 permit, as Council claimed at the last meeting, cannot be pending because it has already been adopted, and there is no tentative MS4 permit because one has not been issued. The ROWD can't be pending because there's no state or federal law that says an ROWD is pending once it's submitted to the Water Board. The Office Chief Counsel invented this requirement based on his own authority in his April 2013 Q&A memo. This constitutes Water Board guidance. At the last State Board meeting, the Office Chief Counsel, Michael Lawford, to his credit, admitted that the Q&A memo is invalid because it is based on Water Code 13287. Mr. Lawford also admitted that because this code was revised without legislative approval, it is invalid. Because the Q&A references 13287 contained in State Senate Bill 965 passed in September 2012, by extension, it also must be invalid. Next slide, please. The Office Chief Counsel also concluded that because 13287 is invalid, that ex parte communication must revert back to the Administrative Procedures Act, Chapter 4.5. It says that communication from the public to a board member is permissible as long as it is disclosed to all the board members and the public. The communication must note its content and the date, time, and location. The board is required to post the communication on its website. It should be kept in mind that the purpose of the ex parte communication rules is to prevent a member or members of the public from having an undue influence over a board member. And here's where this comes from. Code 11430.10. Well, we can skip that. You guys can read that. Next slide, please. Board counsel and members should also take careful note of regarding Government Code 11125.7. Except as otherwise provided in this section. The state body shall provide an opportunity for the members of the public to directly address the state body on each agenda item before or during the state body's discussion or consideration of the item. So if a tentative MS4 permit is agendized, either for a board meeting or a workshop, the public can comment on it before the either the scheduled meeting or workshop, which is usually 10 days in advance, as long as the comments are directed to each board member and are available to the public. That ends my presentation. Anyone have any questions?
Can I just provide some clarification about the FDP site? The FDP site is a technology solution to very big files, and that was used for the permittees to give the files to staff so they could review them. It wasn't meant to be a permanent holding place to make them available to the public. That being said, staff is currently working on reviewing the RWDs with the intention of putting them on the State Water Board's statewide smarts database, which has been historically used to track IGP compliance, construction stormwater. There was a bit of a technological challenge in getting it to work for MS4 documents because it involves so many different permittees and how do you certify the document when it's signed by 20 different people. But they have overcome those. And so that is in process. We will notify Mr. Tahir once the ROWDs are all up on smarts. There's just a lot of documents, and so we're still in flux.
Well, the permittees need to be advised of this. You need to let them know, not just me. And the FTP site, its whole purpose was to contain the ROWDs. They're not there, okay? Period.
It's the purpose is not to be the storage solution. It's meant to transmit. It's like sending an email because the document is too big.
It shouldn't have been referred to. And everyone's under the impression that the ROWDs are contained under that FTP site. There's nothing there.
We have them, but thank you. If you would like them before they go on smarts,
you have to post them on the regional board's website, not on the state board's website.
I think let's conclude this item at this point. Thank you.
All right, the item is concluded on that.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll call you back for the 3 minutes.
Thank you.
All right, next we will hear from Mr. Walter Lamb for 5 minutes, who I believe is joining us virtually.
Yes, good morning, board members. Thank you. Walter Lamb with the Bayano Wetlands Land Trust. This first slide is the same slide that I presented last month. I want to start off with it because, again, you know, we're in a situation where month after month, year after year, and decade after decade has gone by with the Bayano Wetlands with very little progress. So this slide is an excerpt of the letter that was sent on April 20th. Just a quick bit of background. Obviously, this has been going on for 20 plus years, but in December 2024, there was a lot of discussion about this process, and there was sort of an acknowledgement that it wasn't going according, you know, anywhere close to plan, and that if in 2025 no progress is made, then some action would need to be taken. So 2025 came and went, there was no progress, and so the action that was discussed in the December 2025 meeting was to send the proverbial, you know, strongly worded letter, right, as opposed to any kind of enforceable regulatory action. And it took 4 months for that letter to go out. And when it came out, it really wasn't strongly worded. It basically set an arbitrary date for publication of, certification of the draft EIR. The value of the letter was not in speeding anything up. It won't have that impact at all. But it was that we finally got in writing the acknowledgement from the staff that there are other steps that have to happen after that, and that a timeline is going to be needed to understand, you know, when the TMDLs will actually be implemented. And so what I asked last month was to have an informational item where you got some insight into that, because waiting until September 30th to see if the draft EIR has or hasn't been certified really just lets another 4 months go by, 5 months at the time I originally posted this. And so I'm asking again, and I would love if there's a reason that you think, hey, no, let's wait until the draft EIR is certified to get any kind of timeline on these other four steps. I'd appreciate knowing that, because it's really hard to understand why you wouldn't just get at least a bird's eye view of how long Fish and Wildlife thinks that these other four steps will take. I've said many times, one of the reasons we're interested in this is either we're going to learn something or you're going to learn something. What we might learn is that there's some piece of information that we've been trying to get and somehow has eluded us that indicates that this is a viable project as a way to implement the TMDLs. I'd be surprised by that, but I'm keeping my mind, an open mind. The other possibility is that when you see it, the schedule, that it's going to raise bright red flags to you that this project is not anywhere close to implementing the TMDL, and that you might need to think, as Chair Nahai, you had indicated way back in, I think, December 2024, what's Plan B? Now, Plan B could be a very strong solution, a very compelling solution that's just a little bit different than this one. Yeah, probably a lot different, but it's the one that wouldn't need, some of the permits that are going to wind up holding this up. And I just want to say, when we talk about permits, I know there's some people look at those as an impediment. Well, it's the permits that people have to go through that prevent things like wildfire. It's a way for the public to weigh in, not just on opinions, but on information that local people might know, and that raises some good information. So if you just go to the next slide, I just want to walk through some of these next steps that are listed in the letter. So engineering, 30 to 60%. I think the context here is important because this project has been stuck at 30% since 2013. The 30, 60, 90% of design correlate with the federal section 408 permit, right? So for submittal A, you need to be at 30%. Submittal B is 60%. Submittal C is 90%. And then, of course, to construct the project, you have to get to 100%. But it's been stuck at 30% since 2013. So what is your sense of comfort that we're anywhere close to getting to 60, 90, let alone 100? Would be really interested in hearing that. The next slide is related to that slide because it talks about, finally, right, the need to coordinate with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Now, in reality, it's actually the County Flood Control Department that CDFW needs to coordinate with. They're the ones who have to resubmit the application. That's been stalled out for a very long time. In 2019, both CDFW and the Corps acknowledged that it was going to be at least a two-year process, right? That would have taken us to September 2021. We're now getting closer to September 2026, and we've seen no movement, not an inch of movement on that. And there's also a huge cost to that. So I think this assumption that, hey, let's cross one bridge at a time or take one step at a time, I think that's not a good way to approach this solution, because what's happening is you might be wasting time that could otherwise, time and money that could otherwise be used on what you said, Chair Nahai, Plan B, which again, does not have to be that radically different. But at least we need to go back to the drawing board. If you go to the next slide, please. And then the funding is a major, major issue. I know that there are at least two people in this meeting that were at the meeting of the Santa Monica Bay Restoration Commission, where CDFW a year and a half ago said that the price of the project has probably gone up to about $400 million, which is double the original $200 million, but that even the $200 million was, quote, pretty insurmountable, end quote. And so I think what you're finding here is, there's a lot of wishful thinking, and I think it's your job to dig below that wishful thinking, get the answers to the questions that were in your staff's letter, but ask for them now instead of later. And if I'm wrong, I will come up to that podium. I'll drive down to the meeting. I'll come up to the podium. And
how much longer do you have, Mr. Mann?
I'm doing a field trip for the wetlands, so I wasn't looking at my clock. If I've gone over, I apologize. It wasn't my intent. I'm done, and we'll talk again next month, but I'd love to hear some conversation from you and your staff about why wait till September 30th to get this additional information. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. I have two virtual participants for public forum. First, Ms. Patricia McPherson, the Grassroots Coalition, for 3 minutes.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Please go ahead.
Hello, do I have an echo? Hang on 1 second. I'll get rid of my phone. Now can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. This is regarding Biona Wetlands and the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I'm Patricia McPherson, Grassroots Coalition.
Well, no, then let's wait until we get to item 11. We'll hear from you at that point.
I'm sorry, this is for public comment. It's not a part of any agenda item.
Correct, Chair. It's public forum.
Yeah, we're in public forum right now. Would you like to comment in public
yes,
forum or on item 11?
Public comment, please.
Okay, go ahead, please.
Okay, my question is, will the Water Board continue to support a certified Fish and Wildlife RER of the September deadline without first assisting in the performance of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act? Chair Nahai, earlier this year, you commented on being a keynote speaker at a SGMA meeting. So then you can speak to the Department of Water Resources acknowledgement of Biona Wetlands as a groundwater-dependent ecosystem, which entitles Biona to wetland hydrological protection and evaluation. Thus far, however, neither CDFW nor the Water Board have addressed Biona as a groundwater-dependent ecosystem under SGMA for the Southern Santa Monica Basin. I've sent material to staff and board members that, if nothing else is read, please read the restoration ecologist, Dr. Margot Griswold's Audubon article, Inconsistencies and Missed Opportunities in the Current CDFW Plan for Biona Wetlands, photos by Jonathan Coffin. It starts with a letter that Biona is a registered sacred site of the Tongva-Gabrielino people. The land is called Puin-Yucapar, meaning it is filled with water. Biona is filled with fresh water. Perhaps you're unaware, as CDFW did not include in their now overturned FEIR, Biona was acquired and inducted into the ER system as a Title 14, Section 630, which is a non-marine ecological reserve, and by 2005, approved as such by the Office of Administrative Law. Biona's specific purpose and goal of acquisition was to protect its coastal salt marsh and freshwater marsh habitat. Salt marsh connotes vegetation, which at Biona has been predominantly pickleweed, the habitat required for the endangered belding savanna sparrow, for which the site was acquired to provide the best available protection for the belding and other associated imperiled species of Biona. Biona is an important wildlife movement corridor to nearby public lands. A land management plan under Regulation 1019 was required when inducted, and it never happened. It requires hydrological evaluation that today CDFW now claims this plan is in process. We are asking that the Water Board to engage. And Chair Nahai, this means adherence to SGMA protections of Biona's rare coastal freshwater aquifers and surface waters. The waters are classified as potential drinking water. And even SoCalGas, in the litigation that they had to clean up their contamination in a Prop 65, had to treat the water as drinking water. That will change if the water quality change, which certainly it will induction.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your comments. Okay, next, Ms. Chantel Johnson for 3 minutes.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Please go ahead.
Thank you for this time. I am a former resident of the Fountain Park Apartments, and there is a systemic environmental contamination at the Fountain Park Apartment, which include groundwater contamination, methane mitigation system failures, exposure to methane, hydrogen sulfide, and BTEX compounds, and violations of the Playa Vista Methane Prevention Detection and Monitoring Program, which is known as the City's Ordinance 175790. These failures have created hazardous living conditions for the residents and the surrounding community. The failure of the methane gas detection systems to function as required, along with the presence of the toxic groundwater, may be the cause and effect of these health conditions. Because tragically, residents have died while living at the Fountain Park Apartments, and many others are suffering from various health issues. Playa Vista did not notify the Water Board about its groundwater contamination report for the Fountain Park area. Instead, they approached LA Sanitation for permission to discharge the contaminated groundwater into the sewer system. As a result, Grassroots Coalition filed a complaint with the Water Board requesting new groundwater sampling at Fountain Park, which includes sampling of the groundwater being discharged via the sump pumps to LA Sanitation. This is crucial since I believe the Water Board mistakenly issued an NFA to Fountain Park due to Playa Vista's failure to disclose the high-level contamination. The catastrophic conditions at Fountain Park Apartments and the broader Playa Vista community also include the Playa Vista Elementary School, which has already been evaluated by LAUSD and DTSC, confirming the ongoing clogging of the methane system components with groundwater. Despite this, DTSC has relied on the Water Board's groundwater remediation framework while failing to implement the methane safety system protocols. The Water Board has never been part of the oversight for the gas mitigation systems, but they requested the Water Board assume its role for dewatering mitigation at the Playa Vista Elementary School site. Neither DTSC nor LAUSD understood that dewatering oversight was directly part of the methane mitigation system. This is alarming because DTSC and LAUSD failed to clarify to the Water Board the critical importance of dewatering that's necessary to keep the gas mitigation systems operational. The Fountain Park Apartments serve as a model for how the rest of the Playa Vista site has been monitored. And given the recent hazardous events that has occurred throughout the County of Los Angeles, the Water Board must address these matters for public safety. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Is there a response at this time to what we just heard from Ms. Johnson?
Hi, Russ Colby, Assistant Executive Officer with the Water Board. We are in contact with Ms. Johnson. We have received the additional sampling information that she was talking about. We're reviewing it, and we'll get back to her.
Okay. All right, thank you. So I'll ask now Mr. Tahir to come back up for 3 minutes regarding the Gardena Democratic Club. And then we'll go back to see if there are any other virtual people who want to join.
Oh, thank you very much. Appreciate it. I have a presentation. Okay. Right. At the last board meeting, Member Mendez expressed concern regarding the legitimacy of the Gardena Valley Democratic Club. He demanded that they answer his questions. The club's officers, Dan Medina, president, and Susanna Medina, vice president, were offended by Mr. Mendez's brusque inquiry and thought he was disrespectful. They remind Board Member Mendez and all the board members that they have no sovereignty over the club or the public in general. In fact, it is the other way around, as was explained to Bagley Keene. The Medinos were troubled by Mr. Mendez's concern for the validity of the club, while totally disinterested in the ROWD and ex parte communication rules, which are clearly valid. Mr. Mendez should be concerned about the message rather than the messengers. By the way, the club will be hosting a candidates' night sometime after June. They will invite state official candidates, including those running for the governor's office, to attend in person or virtually. They will be asked about who should be appointed to the state and regional boards once they are elected. A word on disclosure. Council claimed that Board Member Mendez properly disclosed his meeting with the City of Long Beach pertaining to stormwater. Actually, he did not have to disclose the meeting because there is no pending MS4 permit. Had there been, all Mr. Mendez would need to do is not only disclose the meeting, but the date, time, and location along of what transpired. Council seems to believe that only the meeting need to be disclosed. She needs to take note of Code Section 11430.440 and the Reasonable Board's own disclosure requirements. Finally, and this is outside of the slide presentation, I am convinced the Board's opposition to my ROWD and ex parte communications is motivated by its intention to roll over the current MS4 permit to the next permit without revision, especially the Watershed Management Program requirement. As I mentioned before, the council's grin, The WIMP is not a mandatory requirement for three reasons. First, the Commission on Unfunded Mandates ruled that the WIMPs are truly voluntary. Second, the Supreme Court upended the Severn Doctrine, which now limits U.S. EPA and the state water boards to Clean Water Act requirements that are specifically called by Congress. Third, the WIMP is not a federal or state requirement, which is only required by the MS-4. Compliance with the MS-4 is determined by 40 CFR 122.26D, which requires the implementation of a stormwater management plan governed by the iterative process. To replace this requirement with a WIMP violates the U.S. Constitution's Supremacy Clause.
And because that last bit of Mr. Deher's presentation was an ex parte communication, despite his protest otherwise, I'm going to ask staff to add that to the administrative record for the permit.
You need to talk to Michael Lawfer about that, because you're totally wrong once again. Thank you.
Noted.
Okay. To be clear, I heard Board Member Mendez's question was really rather more about your authority, which you purport to have, to represent the Gardena Democratic Club here, that there is no disrespect for anybody with respect to that question. As a matter of fact, it should have been a fairly simple process to either produce a letter from the club, or much better, to perhaps have the president of the club or the vice president of the club join us virtually and let us know that you indeed have... That's not going to happen. Well, I mean, you know, this is... So thank you for that answer. That's not going to happen. Okay, let's go on. Ask first, are there any other Zoom participants who wish to speak during public forum?
No, that's all we have, Chair Nahai.
Okay, great. With that, then, we'll conclude public forum. We'll go on to the next item, which are our uncontested items. These items are items number 8 and number 9. Number 8 is consideration of tentative termination of WDRs for Grizzly Bear's Burgers in Acton. And number 9 is consideration of tentative termination of WDRs for the residential community on tract number 49240, also in Acton. So do any board members wish to have these items removed from the uncontested calendar? Okay, great. Hearing none, then, I will ask for a motion and a second to approve staff recommendations on items number 8 and number 9.
So moved.
Second.
All right, thank you. We have a motion from Vice Chair Ashtian and a second from Board Member Christensen. Could we call the roll, please?
Vice Chair Ashtian?
Yes, thank you.
Board Member Christensen?
Yes.
Board Member Mendez?
Yes.
Chair Nahai?
Yes.
The motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you. Motion carries. Thank you very much. Our next item will be the contested items, which are items 10, 11, and 12. I'd like to take a 10-minute break while I get rid of this frog in my throat, and then we can deal with these items. Is that okay with the other board members? Okay. Thank you. So it's now... we'll say 10:20. We'll gather again at 10:30 exactly. Thank you. Okay, we're going to start now. All right, next we'll turn to our contested items calendar. So these are items 10, 11, and 12, and these items will be heard together. However, after the staff presentation, public comments, and board deliberations, the board will vote on each item separately. So I'm going to now administer the oath. Will everyone testifying on items 10, 11, and 12 please stand and take the following oath? This includes the folks who are going to be joining us virtually on this item, and I ask that they do the honorable thing and to take the oath along with the rest of everybody who's going to testify on these items. So, Do you promise that the testimony you are about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, under penalty of perjury? Please respond audibly, I do or yes.
I do.
Okay. Thank you. So these are the three items that we're going to be considering together. The first item, number 10, is consideration of tentative waste discharge requirements and MPDES permits for the City of Thousand Oaks, the Hill Canyon Treatment Plant in Camarillo. Number 11 is consideration of tentative WDRs and MPDES permit renewal for the City of Simi Valley's Simi Valley Water Quality Control Plant in Simi Valley. And number 12 is a time schedule order, and this is the consideration of a TSO for the City of Simi Valley's Simi Valley Water Quality Control Plant in Simi Valley. Let's start, please, with staff presentation. We'll hear from Ms. Veronica Cuevas on items 10, 11, and 12.
Good morning, Chair Nahai, and members of the board. My name is Veronica Cuevas, and I am the project engineer for item 10. Also present with me today are Dr. Don Sai, the project engineer for items 11 and 12, Adam Tang, the acting supervisor for the municipal permitting unit, and Dr. Jung Hee Lim, the manager for the watershed regulatory section. Items 10 and 11 are consideration of waste discharge requirements and NPDES permits for the discharge of tertiary treated wastewater from two publicly owned treatment works, or POTWs, which discharge continuously within Cayegas Creek watershed. Item 10 is for the City of Thousand Oaks Hill Canyon Treatment Plant, or Hill Canyon TP. Item 11 is for the City of Simi Valley, Simi Valley's Water Quality Control Plant, or Simi Valley WQCP. And item 12 is a time schedule order for the City of Simi Valley. The MPDES permits for both of these POTWs are up for renewal and are still in effect. We bring these items to you in a combined presentation, but we request that the board vote on each item separately. Next slide. The City of Thousand Oaks Hill Canyon Treatment Plant and the City of Simi Valley's Water Quality Control Plant are located within the Cayes Creek watershed in Ventura County. They discharge to the North Fork Arroyo Conejo and Arroyo Simi, respectively. Both water bodies are unlined at the point of discharge and have groundwater recharge, or GWR, as a beneficial use in the surface water. This map shows the location of the POTWs and the underlying groundwater basins. The Cayegas Creek watershed is approximately 30 miles long and 14 miles wide, with a drainage area of approximately 325 square miles. Next slide. This slide illustrates the typical flow diagram for the treatment processes at both POTWs. In the primary treatment stage, solids entering the POTWs are removed from the raw sewage and are disposed of at a landfill. In the secondary stage, biological nutrient removal is achieved by using activated sludge and aerators. In the tertiary stage, filters remove or reduce the suspended or colloidal solids. In the final stage, chloramines are added to disinfect the effluent. Prior to discharge, sodium bisulfite is added to reduce residual chlorine down to levels that are not toxic to aquatic life. The tertiary treated effluents from these two POTWs are discharged to tributaries of Cayegas Creek, the City of Thousand Oaks Hill Canyon Treatment Plant to North Fork Arroyo Conejo, and the City of Simi Valley's Water Quality Control Plant to Arroyo Simi. The disinfected effluent is also used for water recycling. According to the 2025 Annual Volumetric Report, the City of Simi Valley recycled 710.91 acre-feet for irrigation purposes under a separate water reclamation requirements order. The City of Thousand Oaks does not hold a separate WRRs for recycling. Instead, It holds a water rights permit issued by the State Water Board's Division of Water Rights, which allows the City of Thousand Oaks to provide up to 15,683 acre-feet per year, or about 14 MGDs of water, for delivery to Camarosa Water District for subsequent use within the Camarosa Water District service area boundary and the Pleasant Valley County Water District's service area boundary. Camarosa Water District diverts water from Conejo Creek, treats it, and delivers it to farmers and other customers in the Santa Rosa Valley for landscape and agricultural irrigation uses. Next, I will discuss the proposed updates as reflected in the tentative orders. Next slide. This is the first of three slides that highlight major updates made to the 2019 orders that are reflected in the tentative NPDES permits for both facilities. The updates include revision of effluent limitations based on reasonable potential, or RPA, as follows. Establishing limits for selenium for both facilities, establishing limits for cyanide and bis-2-ethylhexylphthalate for the Simi Valley WQCP, revising temperature limits for both facilities, and removing the boron limits for the Hill Canyon TP. Next slide. The second set of updates made to the 2019 orders includes removing all narrative receiving water limitations for both facilities, consistent with the Supreme Court ruling City and County of San Francisco versus Environmental Protection Agency 2025, and including a new requirement for both dischargers to conduct new special studies and to address receiving water temperature and pH fluctuations since the receiving water limitations were removed. Next slide. The third set of updates made to the 2019 orders includes updating the dry weather mass space limits for salts for both facilities to reflect the actual formula included in the Cayegas Creek Watershed Salt CMDL. The important thing to highlight about this equation is the flow, represented by the letter Q. Ordinarily, when establishing mass space limits in an NPDES permit, the flow would represent the design capacity of the POTW. For the City of Thousand Oaks, that would be 14 million gallons per day, or MGD, and for the City of Simi Valley, the design capacity would be 12.5 MGD. However, the Cayegas Creek Salts Watershed TMDL specifies that Q represents the flow at the time that the water sample is collected, highlighted in yellow in the above slide, rather than the design capacity of the POTW. Staff included the footnote language in the tentative NPDES permits to be consistent with the Cayegas Creek Watershed Salts TMDL. Staff acknowledges that incorporating this footnote makes the dry weather limits in the tentative orders more stringent than the limits that existed in the 2019 adopted orders, and has included language in the fact sheets explaining the outcome. While the Hill Canyon TP's effluent is expected to be in compliance with these more stringent limits, the Simi Valley WQCP will require additional time to comply with these limits. Next slide. Thus, staff proposed interim dry weather mass-based effluent limitations for TDS, sulfate, and chloride, with specific tasks and milestones in an accompanying time schedule order for the Simi Valley WQCP that is also scheduled for your consideration today as item number 12. As long as the City of Simi Valley complies with the terms of the TSO, it will provide relief from enforcement action or exceedances of the SALT's dry weather effluent limits. Next, I'll discuss the public comments. Next slide. The public notice for the various orders was issued on the following dates: March 8, 2026, for the Hill Canyon TP's tentative permit renewal; March 20th, 2026, for the Simi Valley WQCP's tentative permit renewal; and March 27, 2026, for the City of Simi Valley's tentative time schedule order. The Los Angeles Water Board received three comment letters regarding these items, one for the tentative NPDES permit from the City of Thousand Oaks, one for the tentative MPDS permit from the City of Simi Valley, and one for the tentative time schedule order for the City of Simi Valley. In response to the comments received, staff revised the tentative order where appropriate and distributed the revised tentative orders. All comments were addressed in the response to comments table in your board package, beginning on page 10-237 for Hill Canyon TP NPDS, on page 11-236 for the Simi Valley WQCP NPDS permit, and on page 12-018 for the Simi Valley TSO. I'll only summarize the major comments in the following slide. Next slide. This slide lists the major comments received, grouped by those common to both facilities, those applicable only to the City of Thousand Oaks Hill Canyon TP, and those applicable only to the Simi Valley WQCP. Subsequent slides will provide additional details. Next slide. For comment number one, the City of Thousand Oaks and the City of Simi Valley request removing the requirement for a temperature fluctuation study, since the permit already contains an effluent limitation for temperature. Staff declined to remove the temperature fluctuation study. It's important to understand that Chapter 3 of the Basin Plan contains a two-pronged temperature water quality objective, or WQO, for the protection of the warm aquatic life beneficial use. The first component states that at no time shall these warm designated waters be raised above 80 degrees Fahrenheit as a result of waste discharges. The second component states that for waters designated warm, water temperature shall not be altered by more than 5 degrees Fahrenheit above the natural temperature. The 80 degree Fahrenheit effluent limitation is based on the first component of the temperature water quality objective. And the second component of the W quality objective was formally addressed through the receiving water limitations in the 2019 orders. However, in light of the Supreme Court ruling, City and County of San Francisco versus Environmental Protection Agency, the receiving water limitations have been removed and are not carried forward in the 2026 revised tentative orders. The temperature fluctuation study is necessary to, number one, evaluate, as required by the basin plan, whether the discharge alters receiving water temperature by more than 5 degrees Fahrenheit. Number two, assess seasonal and daily effects of the effluent on the temperature in the receiving water. And number three, provide continuous flow and temperature information as concurrently as possible so that the Los Angeles Water Board staff can conduct a future reasonable potential analysis to address the second component of the temperature water quality objective. The board may recall that stakeholders presented an information item regarding the status of the temperature study during the March board meeting for the Los Angeles River and during the April board meeting for the San Gabriel River. As POTW MPDS permits come up for renewal, the issue of temperature is being addressed for each of the permittees according to their specific situations and watershed conditions. Next slide. For comment number two, the City of Thousand Oaks and City of Simi Valley also request removing the pH fluctuation study because they argue that the receiving water is effluent dominated, that the effluent pH levels do not fluctuate, and that one effluent pH limit suffices. Similar to the temperature discussion on the previous slide, Chapter 3 of the Basin Plan also contains a two-pronged narrative pH water quality objective for the protection of aquatic life. The first component states that the pH of inland surface waters shall not be depressed below 6.5 or raised above 8.5 as a result of waste discharges. The second component states that ambient pH levels shall not be changed more than 0.5 units from natural conditions as a result of waste discharge. The effluent limitation in the tentative orders requiring effluent pH to be maintained between 6.5 and 8.5 standard units at all times is based on the first component of the temperature WQO. The second component of the WQO was formally addressed through receiving water limitations in the 2019 orders. it again. However, in light of the Supreme Court ruling, City and County of San Francisco versus Environmental Protection Agency, the receiving water limitations have been removed and are not carried forward in the 2026 revised tentative orders. So the question becomes, is the effluent pH limit, which addresses only the first prong of the basin plan pH objective, sufficient? The city argues that it is, but more information is needed before that decision could be made. While staff acknowledges that the volume of the effluent discharge is substantially greater than the volume of water contained in the receiving water station located immediately upstream of the discharge, what is commonly referred to as effluent dominated, there is insufficient data to determine the following. Did the pH of the receiving water downstream of the discharge change by more than 0.5 pH units when compared to the pH of the upstream receiving water? If so, was it as a result of the effluent discharge, or was it due to other factors? The pH fluctuation study is intended to shed some light on this issue by doing the following: collecting continuous effluent and receiving water monitoring data collected as concurrently as possible, documenting pH changes in the receiving water, quantifying the daily pH variations in the receiving water, determining if there is a correlation between the effluent pH and the observed receiving water pH, and identifying other factors that may influence changes in the receiving water pH. Information gathered will help address the second component of the pH water quality objective and support future reasonable potential analysis to determine whether or not additional requirements are needed. Next slide. For comment number three, the City of Thousand Oaks and the City of Simi Valley request extending spill notification deadlines beyond 2 hours and removing the notification requirement to interested parties, including the Air Quality Management District, AQMD, local cities, and Heal the Bay. Water Code Section 13271 requires notification of a spill as soon as the discharge is known. The 2-hour reporting timeframe is consistent with other spill reporting requirements for POTWs. While staff declines to remove the 2-hour notification requirement, staff agrees to modify whom should be notified. Therefore, staff replaced the requirement to notify specific recipients named in the order with one that requires the discharger to notify any interested parties who have submitted spill notification requests to the cities. Next slide. For comment number four, the City of Thousand Oaks and the City of Simi Valley request removing and reducing the frequency of monitoring for certain pollutants. Staff acknowledges that monitoring costs can be significant and rise as a result of inflation and other external factors. But the cost of monitoring was considered and is reasonable to ensure consistency with applicable state plans and policies and with US EPA guidance. Monitoring is established to determine compliance with existing permit requirements, evaluate the impact of the discharge on receiving waters, support future reasonable potential analysis, and determine removal efficiencies of the treatment plant. Next slide. Before I present the next comment, I'd like to elaborate on the reasonable potential analysis, or RPA, procedure that's included in the state implementation policy, or the SIP, to provide some background to an issue that will be discussed in a subsequent slide. The reasonable potential analysis in the SIP uses a 3-tiered approach. Tier 1 compares the maximum effluent concentration, or MEC, with the criteria for that pollutant. If the MEC is greater than or equal to the criteria, abbreviated as C, then a permit limit is needed for this pollutant because the effluent causes an exceedance. But if the MEC is not greater than or equal to C, then you proceed to Tier 2. Tier 2 compares the highest measured concentration in the receiving water, or B, or background, with the criteria. If B is greater than C and the pollutant was present in the effluent, then a permit limit is needed for this pollutant because the effluent contributes to the exceedance. But if B is not greater than C, then you proceed with tier number 3. Under tier 3, other information are factored in to make a determination. The SIP lists 10 different factors that could be considered to aid in determining if a water quality-based effluent limit is needed or required. Next slide. For comment number 5, the City of Thousand Oaks requests that the Los Angeles Water Board remove the selenium average monthly effluent limit, or AMEL, and the maximum daily effluent limitation, or MDEL, and reduce the monitoring frequency because the effluent did not exceed the criteria. Although the facility does not demonstrate reasonable potential under Tier 1, it does under Tier 2, because the highest receiving water concentration of 4.4 micrograms per liter exceeds the California Toxics Rule objective of 3.1 micrograms per liter, and selenium is present in the effluent. Under the SIP Tier 2, this constitutes reasonable potential, warranting effluent limitations and a monitoring frequency greater than semiannual. Thus, effluent limitations and monthly monitoring requirements should be retained. Next slide. Finally, comment number 6. The City of Simi Valley requests a compliance schedule within the permit instead of in a time schedule order, or TSO. The city states that they were never afforded a compliance schedule because they were in compliance during the 2014 and 2019 permit cycle. The city asserts that an in-permit compliance schedule is appropriate because the new limits were based on a newly interpreted, more stringent calculation methodology of the Cayes Creek Salts TMDL, and that adding an in-permit compliance schedule is consistent with both the State Water Board's compliance schedule policy and basin plan. The city provided the same comments for item 12 regarding the proposed time schedule order. Staff acknowledges that the city was not provided a compliance schedule previously during the 15-year implementation schedule contemplated in the Cayes Creek Watershed Salts TMDL. Nonetheless, staff does not recommend granting the discharge's request for a 10-year compliance schedule in the permit because it is inconsistent with laws and regulations. The State Water Board's compliance schedule policy caps the length of a compliance schedule at the maximum length of compliance schedules or implementation schedules contained in the TMDL implementation plan. In addition, the State Water Code requires waste discharge requirements to implement the applicable basin plan, which includes TMDL implementation schedules. And federal regulations require that MPDS permits be consistent with the assumptions and requirements of any TMDL waste load allocations for the discharge and any available compliance schedule. However, the December 2nd, 2023 deadline for achieving compliance with the final waste load allocations established in the Cayes Creek Salts TMDL has passed, and it is no longer appropriate to include a compliance schedule within the MPDS permit. If the board wants to provide an in-permit compliance schedule, the mechanism to do that would be through a basin plan amendment revising the TMDL. The TSO is an appropriate mechanism to comply with the salt stray weather limitations. It is a positive offering to the discharger. The TSO is meant to be an enforcement shield, protecting the discharger from mandatory minimum penalties, or MMPs, when the terms of the TSO are met. Although it is issued for a 5-year period, the TSO may be extended in the future for an additional 5 years if warranted. Therefore, staff propose a time schedule order based on Water Code Section 13385 to provide the City of Simi Valley with time to complete tasks for achieving compliance with the dry weather salt limits. Next slide. The Los Angeles Water Board staff recommend that you adopt the revised tentative orders as proposed, with a separate roll call vote for each of the following. Item 10, the City of Thousand Oaks Hill Canyon Treatment Plant's NPDES permit. Item 11, the City of Simi Valley's Water Quality Control Plant's NPDES permit. And item 12, the City of Simi Valley's Water Quality Control Plant's time schedule order. Next slide. This slide provides an overview of the board's options regarding the revised tentative orders. The board may adopt the revised tentative orders for items 10, 11, and 12 as proposed by staff. The board may modify and adopt the revised tentative orders as a logical outgrowth of the public comments received, or the board may choose to take no action today on the proposed revised tentative orders and postpone the consideration to a future board meeting. Next slide. This concludes our presentation, and our team would be happy to answer any questions that you may have. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Thank you. All right. So there are no questions at this time for staff. We'll move on to hear from the City of Simi Valley. So I have a number of cards. Will be the presentation will be led by the Honorable Dee Dee Kavanaugh, who's the mayor of the City of Simi Valley. I understand that Mayor Kavanaugh is joining us virtually. The city has asked for 45 minutes to make its presentation to the board. I understand that there will be a number of speakers from the city, but it'll be led by Mayor Kavanaugh. So let's hear from Mayor Kavanaugh first.
Thank you, Chair Nahide.
Thank you.
My name is Dee Dee Kavanaugh, and I'm the mayor of the City of Simi Valley. We would like to take this opportunity to welcome you to our great city and to thank you for having your board meeting here today. The City of Simi Valley is committed to the protection of the water resources in the Cayugas Creek watershed. We have been a leader in the watershed, spearheading watershed management efforts to identify productive and collaborative solutions to complex water management issues. We are also committed to improving water quality in our discharges in ways that align with a comprehensive approach to solving these problems. We are here today because we have concerns that the new requirements for salts in the Simi Valley Water Quality Control Plant permit will not only necessitate costly treatment for our treatment plant, but also harm our water resource and agricultural partners, providing them with less water in a time when climate change is increasingly putting strain on our local water supplies. We also believe that we have evidence that our discharges are not harming downstream agriculture and groundwater basins, and therefore no changes to our limits are needed to protect them. We are asking you to use the flexibility we believe you have in your regulations to make changes to these limits to allow us to continue collaborative and adaptive problem solving that addresses both water quality and the heightened need we all know that we now have to effectively manage our local water resources. For more details about our concerns and requests, I would like to introduce Al Sexton, our Assistant Public Works Director, to begin our presentation. Thank you.
Next slide, please. Thank you, Mayor Kavanaugh. Good morning, Chair Nahai and members of the board. My name is Al Sexton, and I am the Assistant Public Work Director for the City of Simi Valley. As a little background, as Mayor Kavanaugh stated, the city has been a leader in the watershed management within the Cayugas Creek watershed for more than 30 years. The City of Simi Valley initiated the formation of the Cayugas Creek Watershed Management Group and has chaired the group for much of its existence, spanning over three decades. The Watershed Group worked collaboratively, with the Regional Water Quality Control Board to develop the TMDLs. These were among the first stakeholder-driven TMDLs in the state. This collaborative approach brings together all dischargers and water districts to identify integrated, system-wide solutions and avoid the conflicts that arise when individual dischargers are evaluated in isolation. While today's focus is on Simi Valley's discharge, you will hear that the challenges in the Cayugas Creek watershed that cannot be solved by any single discharger acting alone, effective solutions require collective, coordinated, and creative watershed-level actions. To support these actions, permit requirements and regulatory actions for individual discharges must enable and align with watershed-based strategies, not create obstacles to them. Next slide, please. Introduction to our concern with the permit. So during the permit renewal, the city appreciates the permit as originally proposed in 2024 and only had minimal concerns with the time when it was originally released for comment. At that time, when it was originally released for comment, however, the newly revised salt limits discussed by the regional board staff are now of significant concern. We received little or no advance notice for the 2025 recalculation, and essentially became in non-compliance overnight. And without adequate notification of the new calculation, 10 years of demonstrated compliance were suddenly reversed. As regional board staff acknowledged, the city has been in compliance with salt limits for nearly the entire time the TMDL has been in our permits, often from day one during the 2014 and 2019 permit cycles. The only reason the city would now appear out of compliance is that the change in methodology for calculating the discharge limits has not any change in water quality of the effluent being discharged. As we'll outline today, the city believes the regional board does not need to revise these limits, and doing so is not necessary to protect beneficial reuses. If the limits are changed, they will be newly established and more stringent. The city must be given appropriate time in the permit to meet those new limits. Providing that time will not harm beneficial uses. In fact, without sufficient time for thoughtful, workable solutions, the new requirements could unintentionally do more harm than good to the existing limits. Next slide. So primary request to the regional board is to change the permit limits for chlorides, TDS, and sulfate back to the same limits as in the 2014 and 2019 orders during the TMDL implementation period. The rationale for this is the previous limits were consistent with the assumptions of the TMDL waste load allocations for the fact sheets of those two orders, which, quote, the facilities consistently complying with basin plan water quality objectives, unquote. Agriculture and groundwater recharge benefits uses have not been impacted by the discharges under the higher limits. And as the board has done in the past two permit cycles in 2014 and 2019, regional board staff has had the flexibility in interpreting TMDL waste load allocations into the permit as they previously were. Next slide, please. So if the proposed limits, if you want to maintain the proposed limits, we need an in-permit compliance schedule. So this graph tends to show that that'll give us 10 years of requested in-permit compliance schedule, the 15-year original TMDS schedule, and we've had 0 years of prior schedule to provide compliance. Provide an in-permit compliance schedule for the chloride, sulfate, and TDS rather than a TSO. The rationale is the 2026 permit has a new, more stringent limits for these constituents. Simi Valley Water Quality Control Plant has never been given a compliance schedule for these constituents and requested time period of 10 years of less than 15-year compliance schedule. Agriculture and groundwater recharge beneficial uses have not been impacted over the years during the TMD implementation by the discharges under the higher limits and won't be impacted by the compliance schedule. Next slide, please. So history of the salt limits for Simi Valley Water Quality Control Plant. So in 2008, the salts TMDL became effective, and we had two permits issued during that time frame to when 2023 the salts TMDL was due. Both those permits in 2014 and 2019 incorporated the TMDL limitations, and Simi Valley was never given a compliance schedule for these constituents in any permit since the TMDL became effective. Simi Valley Water Quality Control Plant never received a compliance schedule, and the city is already in full compliance with the final effluent limits on the date they became effective. When the TMDL limits were first added to the city's NPDES permit, regional board staff explicitly informed the city that no compliance schedule was necessary because the facility was already meeting the final effluent limitations. Throughout the entire period, when when a TMDL compliance schedule could have been requested prior to 2023, the city was never notified, formally or informally, by regional board staff that the TMDLs have been incorporated incorrectly, nor that any additional actions were required to maintain compliance. Two successive permits in 2014 and 2019 include the same limits without comment or correction from staff. After the compliance schedule period had already expired, the city was unexpectedly informed that the limits had changed. The city was told there was no remaining time to comply with these new limits and instead issued a time scheduled order, an enforcement action, despite having always complied with the limits as previously issued. Next slide, please. So to provide some context for the rest of the presentation, we wanted to show a map of the Cayugas Creek watershed and highlight a few key features that will be important for the discussion. I think this pointer works. So here's the Simi Valley Water Quality Control Plant to the northeast part of this diagram. As the regional board staff noted, there are locations downstream of the plant where agricultural operations and groundwater recharge occur. So our discharge from Simi Valley goes through Moore Park, comes down here through Somas, heavy agricultural in this area, and approximate dry weather termination right here in this area. During dry weather conditions, all Simi Valley's effluent infiltrates and recharges the groundwater by the time it reaches this portion of the creek. This section of the Cayugas Creek between Somas and Conejo Creek is dry during these periods. So that's this area right here where this arrow is, down to here. It stays dry. And at the bottom is Petrel Road, the point where the original salt objectives were established based on water quality monitoring. We'll discuss this in more detail in a later slide, but please note the significant distance between Simi Valley and Potrero, as well as the long stretch of dry creek between our effluent recharges and groundwater and the location where the objectives were set. Next slide, please. Salt TMDL implementation in the watershed. The Simi Valley has been doing specific actions and along with watershed actions. The city recognizes the importance of protecting agriculture and groundwater within the watershed. For this reason, even though we consistently met the TMDL limits that were in effect at the time, we continued implementing measures to reduce salts entering our treatment plant. We also remained actively engaged in the watershed group and supported broader regional efforts to protect beneficial uses. As we'll discuss later in the presentation, much has changed since the TMDL was adopted. There are now significantly better understanding of how the city's discharge affects beneficial uses and salt conditions. The watershed is currently pursuing actions that balance the need for reliable water supplies with the need for improved water quality to support agriculture and the groundwater basin. These actions differ considerably from those envisioned when the TMDL was first developed, and place less emphasis on Simi Valley's effluent concentrations. So I'm now going to invite up Ashley Desai of Larry Walker & Associates with the next part of the presentation.
Thank you, Al. Next slide, please. Chair Nahai, members of the board, my name is Ashley Desai. I'm president of Larry Walker & Associates. I've been working with the Cayugas Creek stakeholders for over 25 years. If you remember, the SALTS TMDL was a stakeholder-led TMDL developed by the stakeholders in conjunction with the regional board staff. I was actually the lead author on that TMDL, the technical report that was the basis for that TMDL. So I'm very familiar with the requirements. Finding a way to effectively protect agriculture and groundwater recharge when we were developing the SALTS TMDL was very challenging because the TMDL has a very strict way of making requirements that you have to meet in order to be a TMDL. But basically, our primary assumption was that if we reduced the loading of salts to the creek, then we would protect beneficial uses by reducing the loading to the groundwater basins downstream. And because agriculture uses those groundwater basins, then we would be protecting the agricultural beneficial use. We've seen that is true. The result of all of the implementation actions that Al was talking about has been an overall reduction in the salt loadings to the receiving waters. As a result, we're actually meeting the total load capacity that was set for that TMDL. And this reduction And salt appears to be at least maintaining and in several cases reducing the concentrations in the downstream groundwater wells. So you can see in this slide that these green dots, which are the wells that are closest to the Arroyo Simi and could be most impacted by the Simi Valley's discharges, wherever there's a green dot, we see a decreasing trend in the salt concentrations for those wells during the TMDL implementation period. We have one well down here that's stable, so we haven't seen any increasing trends. This was the assumption of the TMDL. Why the TMDL was set as loads rather than concentrations was that we needed to reduce this loading. However, what's happened is that when you look at those implementation actions, most of the reduction in the loads has come as a result of reducing flows to the stream through water conservation, through agriculture, stormwater agencies reducing their dry weather discharges, and as a result, the concentrations in the stream have not decreased. So we're not meeting the water quality objectives in the stream. And so while the actions are meeting the intent of the TMDLs, and I think you'll hear from other speakers, are protecting the beneficial uses, we're reducing loads, the water quality objectives are not being met. And we believe that's, as was written in the fact sheet of the permit, this is one of the primary reasons why the limits for the salts were reduced. Next slide, please. So even though we are not meeting these water quality objectives, we feel that the intent and the beneficial uses are being protected. And the main reason is that agriculture in the Arroyo Simi and Las Poses does not irrigate using surface water. All of their irrigation water is the groundwater basins. And as we showed on the previous slide, the groundwater concentrations in the wells that are could potentially be impacted are actually decreasing or remaining the same, even under the current loads that the treatment plant has been discharging during that entire TMDL implementation period. Additionally, the groundwater objectives for the areas being recharged are being met. And so as a result, the beneficial uses of concern are not being impacted by the current level of discharge. The likelihood of future impacts are minimal based off the history and the continued commitment from the city to reduce influent concentrations and also working towards these goals with the watershed group. Next slide. I think the other thing that's important when we're talking about the fact that we're not meeting water quality objectives is to understand the history of the objectives a little bit. So as Al mentioned, the objectives were set at a very specific point in the Cayugas Creek watershed in the 1975 basin plan. So the original basin plan objectives said these were set at Potrero Road, which, as Al mentioned, Simi Valley's effluent never reached that point. Was also based on the water quality measured at that point and was based on existing water quality measurements. In 1978, there was a change to the basin plan amendment. That there was a change in the word. It was updated from at to above Potrero Road. And that is how these objectives have become applied to Simi Valley. However, if you look at these, I know they're hard to read because they're handwritten, the administrative record, it's very clear that they changed the objectives because of the continuous nature of Conejo Creek, which has the Hill Canyon treatment plant, the Camarillo treatment plant, which were both mentioned in the administrative record. They did not mention Arroyo Simi or the Simi Valley plant. So it appears that those objectives were meant to apply upstream into Conejo Creek. You heard Hill Canyon doesn't have an issue with the salts limits. That's because the objectives were set based off the quality to where they discharge. Simi Valley is very different. They have a very different natural geology, which means they have naturally higher salt concentrations in the Arroyo Simi part of the watershed. If you look upstream of the treatment plant, the salt concentrations are very high in the groundwater. That's part of the reason that the TSO has one of the actions to try to reduce that groundwater entering their treatment plant. And so the challenge is that the salts objectives were never really intended to apply to Simi Valley. The other thing that happened was that in 1994, there was a footnote change that was removed. Originally, they had been set as weighted averages. That footnote went away. We're not exactly sure why, and they became instantaneous maximums. But if you look at the data that was used to set the objective, the maximums are above the objective. So it was intended to be an average. So you can kind of combine all of these changes, and that led us to where we are today, which is needing to change the limits in the Simi Valley treatment plant when they aren't actually impacting beneficial uses to meet objectives that we think were never really intended to apply to this portion of the watershed. Next slide. So as Al mentioned, we think you have more flexibility to make changes and not actually change these limits or provide an impairment compliance schedule. I want to start by saying we fully understand the regional board's interpretation of the TMDL, as well as why they can't give us a compliance schedule, but we feel that there's more flexibility that could be used to make the requested changes. And the main thing is that the Clean Water Act doesn't require that the effluent limits exactly meet what was in the TMDL. Just has to said that it has to be consistent with the assumptions. And so in these previous permits, they had received limits that the finding was that they were consistent with the TMDL. And based off those findings, there was no way for the city to know that the regional board staff would change their mind, that there was a different interpretation of the limits, particularly given that there was no concerns raised by anyone in the watershed about these higher permit limits during that entire TMDL implementation period. And so we believe the only reason now that they're being lowered is because of meeting that receiving water concentration limit when nobody's using the water. Since there was no concern expressed by downstream groundwater managers and agricultural users, and then the fact that the city was being told that the primary need for those people was to just keep water in the stream, there was no indication that the salt concentrations needed to go down more to protect the beneficial uses. Therefore, we don't think there's any need to change the limits. However, if they are going to change, then they should be provided a compliance schedule based on the facts that the limits are new, more stringent than the older limits, which is the key requirement for compliance schedule in the compliance schedule policy. So we've noted they've never had a compliance schedule, and we're asking for a time period that is less than the 15 years allowed by the TMDL and consistent with the compliance schedule policy. And there would be no anti-backsliding or anti-degradation concerns because we're not asking for a higher limit. We understand the regional board staff's interpretation that the compliance schedule policy is that a compliance schedule cannot be granted after the end of the compliance schedule period. However, we feel that there's flexibility in the wording of the compliance schedule policy that would allow you to give them one if you don't change the limits. Granting this request is important because a lot has changed since the TMDL was adopted, and the city needs the flexibility of the higher limits to best protect these beneficial uses. So I'm now going to talk a little bit about how things have changed, how our watershed understanding has changed, and why the water management needs have changed since the TMDL was adopted. Management of salts is really complex, and a rushed implementation process has a strong likelihood to do more harm to agriculture than provide any benefit from the water quality improvement. We'll talk about if you go to the next slide. One of the most significant things that has changed since the TMDL was adopted was the adoption of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. As we discussed previously, the salt impacts of concern are in the groundwater, which is being used by agriculture. When we developed the TMDL, the assumption was that the quality of the groundwater basin would benefit from reducing the amount of flow from the treatment plant, recharging the groundwater basin because of the quality of the water. However, all the analysis done to develop the groundwater sustainability plan in those downstream groundwater basins has changed that assumption. The analysis made it clear that the recharge of the Las Pozas Basin by Simi Valley's discharge is critical to meeting the objectives of the groundwater sustainability plan. The GSP even includes a specific project that would involve the purchase of water for Simi Valley to ensure that water continues to be discharged, regardless of the quality. So it's shown that the water is valuable regardless of the quality to manage that downstream groundwater basin. So why is this important and relevant to the limits? Under the old limits, the city could simply participate in the conversations because there was not a constraint on what they could discharge. Under the new limits, the city will have to evaluate whether or not they can continue to discharge the same amount of flow and also meet the new limits, or if they will have to consider other options. And so I'm going to turn this back over to Al to talk about this a little bit more.
All right, next slide, please. Thank you, Ashley. So salt management is complex and requires watershed solutions, as we've outlined. So where do the salts originate? The water supply is the primary source. Droughts raise effluent levels because water supply concentrations tend to increase. Salty groundwater infiltrating the collection system also raise concentrations. Simi Valley has a very high groundwater table, very high in salts, naturally occurring salts. So how do we reduce these salt levels? Local resources and infiltrating groundwater can be reduced, but supply salts are largely beyond our control. What comes into the treatment plant is what goes out. Regional approaches can improve water supply and desalt groundwater. If source control fails, reverse osmosis of effluent is our only alternative. RO-treated water is best used for city supply and drinking water reuse and or expansion of our recycled water projects without regard for watershed beneficial uses. So the implication of CME's selection of salt management actions is focusing solely on reducing effluent concentration risks harming agriculture rather than helping it. Balancing water resource and water quality needs requires time to implement the right solutions. Next slide, please. So the implications for Simi Valley. The salt objectives were never developed nor intended to apply to Simi Valley Water Quality Control Plan. They were based on water quality conditions in a reach that Simi Valley's effluent does not enter. The Basin Plan Administrative Record does not indicate that these limits should apply to Simi Valley. Instead, the record repeatedly addresses Hill Canyon and Cameroon. Downstream groundwater concentrations do not show any impairment at current effluent discharge concentrations. Local agricultural users actively support recharge of the groundwater supply and have expressed little concern with water quality, that the water is needed and compatible with their everyday needs. The city is taking responsible and proactive steps to manage salts. Simi Valley continues to expand source control programs, reduce upstream contributors, and participate in watershed level coordination to further improve water quality and protect agricultural uses. Despite this, the regional board is now imposing more stringent limits and pursuing an enforcement order. This is occurring even after the board previously stated that the city's existing limits were consistent with the TMDL. Instead of providing a compliance schedule or collaborative approach, the city is being placed under an enforcement action for limits that were neither intended nor supported by evidence of any groundwater degradation from the Simi Valley Water Quality Control Plant's effluent discharge. Next slide, please. So our requested action. 5 years ago, and again, 5 years before that, we stood before this board for adoption of the 2014 and 2019 permit renewals. During those hearings, we praised your regional board staff and our TMDL stakeholder group working together for collaborative efforts to taking watershed-wide approach to protecting beneficial uses. Together, we have developed and implemented realistic and attainable salt limitations within those permit renewals. Unfortunately, it feels as though we have lost sight of that environmental stewardship. The city understands the regional board staff's position that they must revise the TMDL limits because the receiving water objectives are not being met, and that they believe they cannot include in the in-permit compliance schedule since the final TMDL deadline has already passed. However, from our perspective, there's more flexibility available than staff has acknowledged, and that the regulatory history and precedents we have shared today clearly demonstrate that this flexibility can be used responsibly by this board. We hope we have also shown the city's longstanding commitment to protecting beneficial uses while working toward doable, practical solutions. The challenges we face are dynamic and will continue to grow more complex with climate change and the evolving water source resource needs of Southern California. For these reasons, we're asking the regional board to provide us with the flexibility necessary to address these challenges holistically rather than focusing on a single discharge requirement in isolation. To that end, we request that the regional board direct staff to revise the effluent limits for salts so that they are calculated using the plant's design flow rather than the instantaneous flow at the time of discharge. This change would provide the Simi Valley with the same limits we had under our last two permits in 2014 and 2019, and would also support regional water sustainability by allowing us to coordinate with downstream groundwater managers to maximize flow availability for groundwater recharge. If the board does not move forward with that change, we request you direct staff to include an impermit compliance schedule, consistent with the discussions we had with staff when this issue first arose. A 10-year compliance period would allow us to identify and implement solutions that align with our understanding of how the watershed and best practices to protect downstream users. That concludes our presentation. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you for your presentation. All right. We have a number of additional cards to speak on this item, so I'll call on them first in person. Ms. Amy Mueller from Cayugas Municipal Water District.
Hello, Chair Nahai and members of the board. My name is Amy Mueller from the Cayugas Municipal Water District. We are here today to support the City of Simi Valley's request to maintain the salts permit limits that they have had in their last two permits. Managing water in the Cayugas Creek watershed is becoming increasingly complex due to climate change, reduced supplies, and influent-dominated streams due to conservation and the increased need to develop and maximize local water supplies. Cayugas Municipal Water District and other water and groundwater managers in the watershed have invested in infrastructure such as the salinity management pipeline and studies to evaluate options to maximize the water resources available. We have learned a lot since the SALTS TMDL was adopted in 2008 about what is needed to manage water resources in the watershed. One key finding is that the value of Simi Valley's effluent has a major source of recharge for downstream groundwater basins. This value is being provided at their current salt discharge quality. Water managers in the Cayugas service area are capable of managing salts and water supplied to end users at the concentrations they need for their various applications, including specific crops, manufacturing processes, and irrigation methods. For example, we are currently evaluating potential locations for desalting groundwater. It is much more effective to manage salts in this way than through treating salts at the point of discharge. We encourage you to maintain the limits for the salts from the previous permit to maximize flexibility for the city and water managers to jointly work together to balance water quality and water resource needs in the watershed. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Next, Mr. John Demers from Fox Canyon GMA.
Good morning, Chair Nahai, members of the board. My name's John Demers, the executive officer of the Fox Canyon GMA. I'm here today to support the City of Simi Valley's request to maintain the same salts permit limits that they have had for their last two permits. Fox Canyon GMA is the agency responsible for managing the Las Poses Valley groundwater basin located downstream of the Simi Valley treatment plant's discharge, as well as the Pleasant Valley Basin and the Oxnard Basin. All of these basins are overdrafted. As GSA for the basins, we closely follow all changes that may impact groundwater sustainability. We led the development of the GSP for the LPV basin, which included an in-depth analysis of the quantity and quality of the water in the basin, the sources of water available to the basin, and the measurable objectives necessary to sustainably manage the basin. As part of that analysis, Simi Valley's discharge into the Arroyo was identified as a key source of water recharging the basin. Model scenarios confirmed the link between flow in the Arroyo and the amount of groundwater in storage in the LPV basin. Around 1970, the upstream wastewater treatment plant and shallow dewatering wells discharges began reaching the eastern portion of the LPB basin, converting the Arroyo Simi Las Poses from an ephemeral stream to a perennial one. That perennial flow provided recharge to the underlying groundwater aquifers, causing water levels to recover in areas adjacent to the channel. Maintaining the water as a source of recharge was identified as a project that would significantly contribute to the sustainable management of the basin. At this time, maintaining the flow in the Arroyo Simi is one of the key objectives for LPB basin management, and the existing flow is factored into the operating yield in our recently completed basin optimization yield study. Without this recharge, the sustainable pumping yield of the LPV basin would be reduced. The Pleasant Valley Basin also benefits from the Arroyo flow through downstream underflow and would be impacted as well. The analysis also identified that maintaining water levels in the basin was important for managing water quality, but it did not identify the need to improve the quality of Simi Valley's effluent to sustainably manage the basin. We would be very concerned with any requirement that would increase the likelihood that Simi Valley would reduce the amount of water they are discharging to the Arroyo Simi, even if it reduced the concentration of salts in the discharge. The new salts limits raise that concern for us. If the salt limits are not attainable for the city without costly treatment, it is more likely that the city will reduce their discharges to the stream and treat all of their effluent to meet the limits due to the high costs and the other potential uses for that treated water. If that were to occur, the amount of discharge available for groundwater recharge would be reduced, resulting in a corresponding reduction in the sustainable yield of the basins and possibly reducing the amount of water available to the agricultural community, the mainstay of this county's economy. As Cayegas Municipal Water District mentioned, a study was recently commenced to investigate the need for a regional desalter facility to transform the naturally salty groundwater prevalent in the region into water available. And I would indulge the board's permission to exceed my time limit slightly here.
Well, how much more time do you have?
About 20 seconds, sir.
Okay.
The very significant investment required to build and operate a desalter requires a regional approach to ensure that public investment is optimized and results are maximized for all communities. Any requirement for Simi Valley to shoulder this burden alone would be premature. We encourage you to consider what flexibility you have in providing the city with requested effluent limitations to allow us to have more flexibility to work with the city to maintain their water as a source of recharge.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks very much. The next card is from a virtual speaker, Ms. Jody Switzer from the Farm Bureau of Ventura County.
Good morning. Can everybody hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Hi.
Great. Thank you. Good morning, Chair Nahai and members of the board. My name is Jody Switzer, and I'm the Water Program Director for the Farm Bureau of Ventura County, which manages the Ventura County Agricultural Irrigated Lands Group, or VCALG. I also serve as the Program Manager for the Cayegas Creek Watershed Stakeholder Group. I am here today in support of the City of Simi Valley's request to maintain the salts permit limits included in their last two permits. This year marks the 30th anniversary of the Cayegas Creek Watershed Stakeholder Group and decades of collaborative problem solving in the watershed. VCALG is one of the largest contributors to this effort, and we've worked closely with municipalities, water districts, and regulators to address complex watershed challenges, including salts management. In recent years, VCALG and the Farm Bureau have also been heavily engaged in groundwater sustainability planning throughout the watershed. With increased pressure from groundwater sustainability requirements, climate change, and rising costs, water supply reliability has become a critical issue for agriculture. In the Arroyo Simi and Las Poses area, Simi Valley's effluent is an important source of groundwater recharge for downstream agricultural users. These growers rely on the groundwater basin replenishment, in part, by these discharges as a primary water source. From the agricultural perspective, The effluent quality under the limits included in the last two permit cycles has not resulted in groundwater salts concentrations that are creating operational concerns for downstream agricultural users. Salinity management is important to agriculture, particularly in Ventura County, where we grow many high-value crops. But growers today are balancing multiple pressures, including groundwater sustainability requirements, water supply reliability, and increasing costs. In this area, maintaining recharge and overall water availability is the more pressing concern for downstream growers. Agricultural irrigation and salts management practices have also evolved significantly since the salts TMDL was adopted in 2008, and growers are much more sophisticated in how they manage salinity impacts on crops and soils. Our concern is that if these limits are not attainable without costly additional treatment, the more likely outcome may be reduced discharge rather than treatment of all effluent to those levels. For the downstream agricultural community, reduction in flow and recharge would be of much greater concern than the current salts concentrations in the effluent. We respectfully encourage the board to consider what flexibility may be available to accommodate the city's request and support continued discharge to the Arroyo Simi for downstream recharge and beneficial use. For 30 years, watershed stakeholders have worked collaboratively to balance water quality objectives and real-world watershed needs. As the primary beneficial user affected here, we encourage regulatory approaches that continue supporting that collaboration and avoid unintended consequences for downstream water users. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much. Do we have any other virtual speakers? No? Okay, none. All right, so with that, we can move to board questions and deliberations. I know I have some questions for staff, but would you, somebody like to start us off? Would you like me to do that? Whatever you say.
Yeah.
Would you? Yeah. Okay, all right. Well, Ms. Cuevas, will you come up? Thanks so much. So let me start with a couple of questions that I had from and then I want to get to the kind of the nub of the issue here, which is the salts and how we're going to address that part. So so regarding PFAS, first of all, so the US EPA limited the number of PFAS under consideration, we'll put it that way. So in the permit, in terms of monitoring for PFAS, which elements are we talking about? How many of them?
The permit doesn't specify the list of PFAS. We specify the test method. So whatever the test method requires would be generating a list of PFAS that would be available for that. And it's correct. We're using US EPA guidance and recommending that the POTWs monitor their effluent for PFAS on a quarterly basis.
Okay. And then next question regarding temperature. I was a bit puzzled by the city's objection to having a fluctuation study, because if the permit is going to go from 86 to 80, wouldn't they prefer to have a study to perhaps try to change that limit to a higher number? Or
I can't speak for the city's behalf, but I'm the permit writer for the City of Thousand Oaks Hill Canyon Treatment Plant. Don Tsai is the permit staff who worked on the City of Simi Valley's NPDES permit. I believe the City of Thousand Oaks' main concern was the cost, and that also is tied to, since they believe they have a good handle on the effluent and the temperature coming out of their plant, they don't think that they should be responsible for what happens in the receiving water, even though they assume that their discharge won't cause some kind of effect in the receiving water. But what we're saying is we need data to make that decision. We can't just assume because it's effluent-dominated. Effluent-dominated doesn't mean that the effluent's not going to cause an impact. We want to know, like, with facts, does it or does it not cause an impact? And that's why we're asking all the dischargers to do that study. So depending on the conditions of the watershed for each individual POTWs, the extent of the study might differ. So first we would need to get a work plan submitted to us from the city, we would review that work plan. We would work with them to try to see the extent of the study that would be required in the Cayugas Creek watershed.
Okay, but the permit limit that is being that we're being asked to approve today would lower the temperature from 86 to 80.
Correct. The okay. 80 has been in the basin plan since, I believe, in 94. We had been using the 80 based on a white paper that staff would rely on, but that was an average number more applicable to an estuarine condition, and since we are not anywhere close to the estuary, we're sticking to the number that's straight from the basin plan. The 80 has been in the basin plan, and we were told by legal staff we need to put in the permits whatever is included in the basin plan.
I think I understand the chair's question. Can I add some more?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So the plants aren't having trouble meeting the 80, and the temperature study that we're requiring in the permit is related to that Delta 5 basin plan objective we've been talking about. So the permit used to previously say as a receiving water limit, you can't change the temperature in the water by more than 5 degrees. And so so we've taken that receiving water limit out in response to the Supreme Court ruling, and now we need a way to decide if we're going to translate that into another permit, another kind of permit limit. And that's what we need this temperature fluctuation study for, is to get the information for that. So the reason the treatment plant may not want it is because of cost, like Veronica said. But the reason we want it, I think you were thinking it might benefit them by giving them a greater temperature objective. It might, but the point of the study is to calculate a potential future different objective.
Yeah, I would say, but it might.
It might.
But because the limit that we're adopting today, if we adopt the staff's recommendation, is 80. That is what we're being asked to approve.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. That's going to the issue of salt. So, you know, and I have some sympathy for the city's position in that it's clear that this kind of change from design capacity to average daily flow has now resulted in a more stringent requirement being imposed. And I also come out that is necessary. I've heard about, you know, the presentations we've had about, you know, the reduction in flow, possibly. I'm not quite sure that I'm on board with that scenario, because time will be given to the city in order to comply. So I don't know that necessarily having a more stringent limit necessarily results in a reduction in flow. I wasn't quite persuaded by that line of argument. However, I think the issue of the amount of time and the mechanism is an important one. And I understand the city's position that, you know, that even though a TSO will have the same, you know, impact in reality as a compliance schedule in the permit itself, it nevertheless is viewed as an enforcement mechanism. Mm-hmm. So I understand that objection. And as far as the time is concerned, you know, given the fact that this was a switch that has happened, that the city necessarily was not, you know, wouldn't. They need the time to comply. And I think we have to give them that. The question is whether 5 years is sufficient for that. You know, we can arrive at a number, but I would very much like there to be a conversation with our lawyers about whether we can accommodate the request for this to be an in-permit compliance period rather than a TSO, which is viewed as an enforcement order. And I don't know if we can take some time to do that, because, as I say, I have some sympathy for the city. You know, They've been going along. I looked at the compliance history. We looked at the compliance history. There was, I think, on sulfate, perhaps an exceedance. But apart from that, they've been meeting the permit limit. And now, because of this change between looking at design capacity and average daily flow, there's a more stringent limit. They need to have time to comply. And even though they ask for the limit to stay as it was, nevertheless, they concede that this board has, or at my reading is, that they concede that this board has a responsibility. And that responsibility is to impose the limits that are required. And the fact that a treatment plant doesn't have control over the influent into the, you know, this is the job of a treatment plant, you know. That's the job. You know, I don't have control over many things that come at me in my life, but I've still got to deal with that, right? So I don't have any sympathy there. I don't believe that a reduction in flow is an absolute necessity from what we're doing here, but I think that we must take a look at a compliance history within the permit itself rather than a TSO. And you know, the question of time, I think we need to talk about. That's kind of where I come out on all of this. So,
Chair Nahai, did you want staff to respond to that or start up the discussion? We're prepared now to talk about the legal implications, or do you want to hear from the other board members?
Yeah, I'm waiting for the other board members to tell me. I'm kind of full of it. So,
all right. Thank you, Chair, for that opening remarks. I think we all knew you would be able to characterize a lot of our feelings. I also like to thank Simi Valley and the stakeholder group for their 30 years of collaboration, working together, and engaging in compliance. And this is quite a lot to take in, so I think we would appreciate some staff comments to the chair's question. But I do want to acknowledge this idea that particularly for the city of Simi Valley, that they have been in compliance for many years, and in all intents and purposes have been good actors, and are not like the other regulated entities that we often see asking for extensions and over and over, or what we classify as calcitrant regulated entities. So I want to acknowledge that, of the good faith efforts that the city has done. And I, in particular, thank you to the consultant for doing a thorough research and even going into the archives but we also have to acknowledge our regulations are not immutable. They do change over time. So that's why we are here today to discuss what is appropriate, but also providing that flexibility that the chair mentions. I do hesitate on a 10-year extension, but am open to looking other appropriate avenues where we can provide the city with additional time or resources, particularly, again, because they have showed a history of complying and being good actors in their watershed.
I want to thank you, Chair Nahai, for encapsulating everything so well, and also Board Member Mendez for your comments. I want to thank Simi Valley and all of the stakeholders that came to speak. I think that there is a lot of collaboration. We've seen this over the course of other discussions within this region. There's so much collaboration and coordination with various entities and stakeholders in Ventura County. I think that's what makes it such a wonderful place to live, I will say. So I want to make sure that we're working with that spirit of collaboration, because I think that, like Board Member Mendez said, it's different than some of the regulated entities that we sometimes deal with, where there is more of a desire to just prolong things. But I echo the comments about whether it's possible to do a five-year in-permit compliance schedule rather than the rather than moving to the TSO, because even though that does have the same feeling, I appreciate that it is an enforcement mechanism and it does have that feeling of punitive or punishing sentiment. But I know that in the presentation that you gave, you provided a rationale for why that isn't possible and why a new, why everything would be need to be opened up again and redrawn. So I'm wondering if we could have a conversation about that either today or if we need to continue it to a future session, although I think that the board
we're prepared
staff is ready to discuss
to do it
that.
Today.
Thank you. That was a rambling response.
So I guess I will step in here.
If you don't, Marissa wanted to add a question.
Yeah, thank you. You referenced several times the Supreme Court case, San Francisco versus the EPA. Can you give us just a really top-level summary of what those circumstances were?
Maybe our attorney could do it since it's a Supreme Court
issue. Sorry.
just from what I understand is when NPDES permits were issued for a facility in the San Francisco Regional Board area, they challenged some of the requirements, and as a result, it affected permits in the whole state. And so based on that Supreme Court decision, we're no longer able to include, there's like A through G, or there's a whole bunch of a slew of receiving water requirements that used to be in our NPDES permits, and because of that lawsuit, we can't put them in our permits anymore. So we had to decide, is there an existing NPDES effluent limit that could address that receiving water limit that requirement that used to be in our permit? If the answer is yes, well, there was nothing to do. If we were questioning, like, we can't really tell, then we're asking for a study. That's the case of temperature and pH. And that's from my non-attorney point of view. Maybe Adriana could speak for more legal basis.
Yeah, and I'll just add maybe a little more nuance. So the Supreme Court was interpreting what types of requirements we could require consistent with Clean Water Act Section 301C, which and there the specific provision that was challenged was a pretty standard provision on all our permits, which was do not cause or contribute to a condition of pollution or nuisance. And ultimately, the Supreme Court, you know, said that 301C gave EPA and by extension the water boards the ability to put requirements on the discharge itself, but not on the quality of the receiving water. That doesn't necessarily mean we don't have authority to do it under state law, but for permits that we're adopting under Section 301C of the Clean Water Act, such as this one, we are being consistent with that direction. There might be other ways that we could do it, but in terms of deciding whether to exercise our state law authority, you know, part of that calculus was, were there other conditions that we could put that would still be protective of the water quality objective? And where we don't have more information, that's why we're asking for studies.
Great.
I hope that clarifies.
Thank you. Thank you both. So I too want to thank the cooperation and partnership from these municipalities over the course of time, and am also interested to hear if there is some way of moving towards a compliance schedule. And I think my primary comment to all of this is, We are clearly living in an era of rolling back environmental protections, the likes of which will certainly get us into hotter water in the future. And so I think maintaining as much as we can the spirit of the receiving waters that we want to protect and why and how is important. And as much as, you know, today's conditions show that downstream agricultural beneficial uses don't come from surface water, and that there's a long dry portion of some of those receiving waters. I think what we all know from recent climate events is that history and current conditions don't really help us much these days. You know, our models aren't keeping up with the trends and the future to come. And so I agree with you that we need to really promote and uphold evidence-based decision-making and not assume anything about the receiving waters, and also not assume that downstream beneficial uses will continue to draw from the sources that they're drawing from today. And that's all I'll say. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Would you like to comment, Jenny?
So, how about this, Jenny Newman? How about I tee up the discussion and provide some background before Adriana gives some legal input, and then MPDS staff can chime in as necessary. Okay, so to discuss whether or not a compliance schedule or a TSO is the appropriate mechanism, I think you should have a little background. Also, I wanted to take the opportunity to respond to some of the comments from the city's consultant about the TMDL and its origins, and as from the city as well. I think that'll help explain why or whether a compliance schedule or a TSO is appropriate. So just off the top, I know you heard from the city that, you know, and throughout the presentation, asking for a regional approach, a watershed approach, not this site-specific POTW effluent limit approach. That's exactly what the TMDL is, and as they pointed out, it was a stakeholder-led TMDL, so these stakeholders, including Simi Valley, other dischargers and water purveyors in the region and water users in the region, all came up with this approach, and it's a salts balance in the watershed, and it relies on export of salt from the watershed through reductions in POTW effluent combined with pumping of groundwater and desalting it, and the brine line that was constructed and is, as you know, still possibly being extended. So it's a very complicated salts balance in the watershed. The allocation in the TMDL, the way it was written, is very important to maintain that salts balance. That's why it was written that way. Those formulas were very carefully crafted, so when they're put all together, all the sources will achieve that salts balance. And so why the design storm was incorporated into the permit rather than the actual storm in 2014, we can only speculate. But Ashley Desai pointed out, she wrote the TMDL and is the consultant for the City of Simi Valley. So it's not, I mean, I don't know why it wasn't pointed out that the wrong flow has been in the permit for so long. But we, you know, we acknowledge that it has been, and that now the staff are interpreting it differently. And we are, you know, we need to provide a schedule. We don't want to put the city immediately out of compliance. But the, you know, I feel like a lot of the argument about changing conditions in the watershed and the technical and regulatory underpinnings of the basin plan objectives that are the foundation of the TMDL are not the place here. If the stakeholders wish to revise the TMDL, then they need to bring forth that request and, you know, another stakeholder-led effort to revise the TMDL. I will say that all of those, that information about the basin plan and the origins of the objectives was all known at the time the TMDL was adopted in 2008. But anyway, I just wanted to lay that groundwork to, like, because they're saying that because the discussion about whether to include a compliance schedule or a TSO kind of depends on that 15-year implementation schedule that was already in the TMDL. And so wanted to make it clear that TMDL schedule was tied to this, to the the actions and the waste set allocations assumed for that TMDL and the fact that they were incorporated differently into the permit, we're going to argue it shouldn't make a difference. So I wanted to lay that groundwork that just the it's very important how the waste set allocations are calculated in terms of maintaining that salts balance, and that was the reason for the schedule as it was put in the TMDL. And I'll turn it over to Adriana unless I said something wrong and permitting staff want to. No, okay. They're okay.
And just wanted to clarify, it wasn't the design storm. It was the design capacity, the POTW.
Oh, my gosh,
design
thank you.
Event is stormwater. We're talking about POTW's design capacity. That's the only thing.
Thank you, design capacity.
But I think the point from the board is that the fact that the wrong, if you want to call it that, standard was put in the permit to begin with, that cannot be laid at the door of the discharger. It wasn't their fault. And so now that I acknowledge that there has to be a change, that means, though, and we all agree, that means, though, that additional time has to be given to the city in order to comply with now this new standard, correct?
Okay. Yeah.
So just to finish, the question becomes how much time and under what mechanism? Okay. So if we go TSO, I think a TSO limits us to 5 years. Am I right?
It can be extended to 10 years. It doesn't limit to 5 years.
I'm sorry, say that again?
It can be extended to 10 years?
Yeah, but it can. I understand it can be extended, but it's not automatic. There would have at the end of 5 years, there would have to be a process,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
And if you correct me on this, and a TSO, if not complied with within the time period, there is an enforcement that follows that. So this is why I think the board has got, you know, is in this. This is why we would rather see a compliance schedule, and then the time could be 5 years, could be something between 5 and 10. I don't know, but. Is there a possibility that we could perhaps take maybe 20 minutes, half an hour, and see if the lawyers can find the way for us? Or is that not?
The lawyers...
I am so sorry that I did the preamble before Adriana talked, and I'm keeping doing it. She's ready to talk about it right now. I just wanted to lay the groundwork for that.
Right. Thank you, Jen.
I understand the board's concerns. My recommendation, if the board wants to provide an in-permit compliance schedule, the TMDL needs to be revised because the TMDL has an end date, and the end date was 2023, and the fact of the matter is that the water body is still impaired. The surface water body is still impaired. Everyone came up and acknowledged that the water body isn't meeting the salts limitation in the basin plan. Whether the water quality objective is the appropriate objective is a separate question. And so, you know, when in terms of their rules, when there can be compliance policies in permits, there are specific findings that have to be made, and so one, we have to follow the water code, which says implement our basin plan. And our basin plan in the chapter related to TMDLs says there's a 15-year compliance schedule. It doesn't say there's a 15-year implementation schedule once we interpret the waste load allocation correctly. Maybe it would have been nice if it did. We could have handled it that way, but it doesn't. It has a specific end date, and so that's. It's not that I'm not sympathetic to the fact that clearly a mistake happened and it was allowed to live for a lot longer than anybody sitting at these tables feels comfortable with. Even if the board is inclined to do a basin plan amendment so that the permit can be reopened for an in-permit compliance schedule, my recommendation would still be to adopt the TSO today, because the compliance schedule policy specifically says you can't use it when you need more time to do a TMDL, which is what we need. And in terms of, you know, I get that maybe sometimes there is wiggle room in terms of what it means to be consistent with the assumptions and the requirements of the TMDL. That might be appropriate in terms of how you interpret the waste load allocation. However, when the waste load allocation expressly says to use the actual flow at the time of monitoring and does not distinguish between POTWs that are in the upper watershed and POTWs in the lower watershed, it would seem
be difficult to make the findings that allowing Simi Valley to have a more relaxed wasteland allocation, even if it's consistent with beneficial uses downstream, is actually consistent with the assumptions and requirements of the TMDL. And even if I can, even if we interpret it flexibly to say, well, the TMDL assumed a 15-year schedule once the wasteland allocation was applied, so maybe we don't apply that date, then we go back to the compliance schedule policy, which it does allow 10-year schedules for newly interpreted water quality objectives or criterion. Arguably, this isn't a newly interpreted water quality. The objective is the same. The wasteload allocation, how it's expressed in the permit, might be different. And the compliance schedule policy, to the extent that it talks about, you know, using compliance schedules based on TMDL implementation schedules, it sets the max at what's in the permit. So, you know, by the letter of the law, does this feel fair? It might not feel fair to the board. But the board is not without a remedy. But again, my recommendation is the remedy is a basin plan amendment. And so in the short term, if that's the route and the direction that you want to provide, one option, I guess, would be not to adopt the permit today and allow the prior permit to continue on administrative extension. I don't think staff would recommend that.
No. The board does not want to amend the basin plan or to go back and redo the TMDL.
And the other option is to adopt the permit as is with the TSO. The milestones in the TSO were developed in coordination with Simi Valley so that they would be milestones that they could meet within the 5 year. We don't want to set TSO milestones and interim objectives at something that the dischargers can meet because that would undermine the purpose of the TSO. We want to give them an interim compliance option. It's just not in the permit. And I understand that they're, practically speaking, they have, you know, different litigation risks exposure because it's not in the permit. In terms of the board's, you know, enforcement, even whether there were MMPs would depend on, you know, how much of an exceedance there was, how often the exceedances there were, however, it's really speculative at this point to say that even if they missed a milestone, that there would be enforcement right then and there. And then in terms of the cap at the 5 year, it's one of the things in the water code I wish was different. but it's, you know, I think we understand that they might need a 10-year solution. But again, the milestones were set that even if they need a 10-year solution, that they should be in compliance with the TSO for 5 years. And then they can request an extension. We would add additional milestones. So it, if there's any further questions, I'm happy to take them. I don't want to be the meanie or the bad guy. Unfortunately, you know, this is how we read the law. So.
All right, thank you. Are there any other questions? I think we've received our legal advice that our hands are tied here. Are there any other questions of staff or any other deliberations on the part of the board? Okay, well, in that case, then I'll move approval of the staff recommendation on items 10, 11, and 12.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion. We have a second. Let's call the roll.
Sorry, I think we were going to recommend doing three separate roll call votes if we could separate it instead of consolidating.
Yeah. So let's have a roll call vote first on item number 10. Ms. Bolivar?
Vice Chair Ashian?
Yes.
Board Member Christensen?
Yes.
Board Member Mendez?
Yes.
Chair Nahai?
Yes.
Motion carries. Thank you.
Okay. Motion carried. That was a motion from Nahai with a second from Board Member Christensen. Next, the roll call on item number 11.
Vice Chair Ashian?
Yes.
Board Member Christensen?
Yes.
Board Member Mendez?
Yes.
Chair Nahai?
Yes. Again, that was a motion by Nahai, second by Board Member Christensen. Motion carries. And now let's move on to item 12.
Vice Chair Ashian?
Yes.
Board Member Christensen?
Yes.
Board Member Mendez?
Yes.
Chair Nahai?
Yes.
The motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you. That too was motion by Nahai, second by Board Member Christensen. Motion carries. Okay. That concludes our board items for today. We will now adjourn to closed session. Council, would you like to talk about our closed session?
Yes. We're going to adjourn in closed session for agenda item 13C, Parents Against Santa Susana Field Lab, Physicians for Social Responsibility, LA, and Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility versus California Department of Toxic Substances Control, Lawrence Hafitz in his official capacity, and the California Regional Water Quality Control Board, Los Angeles Region. Also, agenda item 13L, little I, a matter which, based on existing facts and circumstances, the Los Angeles Water Board is deciding whether to initiate litigation. And finally, agenda item 13L, little I, consideration of the appointment, employment, or evaluation of performance about a public employee.
Thank you. So we will adjourn into closed session. We will not be coming back into this room afterwards. Our next regular meeting of the board will be on June 25th of 2026, and that'll be at the regional board office at 320 West 4th Street in Los Angeles. Thank you so much.